And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. I'm sorry about the delayed start, technical problems, and various other things. So, I'm now here with Mark Webber. I think Mark will be known to most of you already, but just in case he isn't, Mark, welcome to the show. It's your debut, your first time on Millennial, so again, another debut. And could you introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, I'm an American. I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon. I've lived in different parts of the United States, and I've lived overseas as well. I have had an interest in history since I was very young. I moved to California in 1991 to work for the Institute for Historical Review. I just came on as just a sort of low-level person at that time. And other people have left. There's been a lot of changes in the meantime. And so now I'm director of the Institute for Historical Review. Although the name is perhaps pretentious, it's a small organization. We don't have a very large staff. But we have, I think, a track record that I'm pleased with, that we've had influence and we've stuck to what we've done for years. And one reflection, I guess, of our impact is how organizations like the ADL and SPLC and so forth have had me and the IHR on its roll of honor for many years. From a very early age, growing up in Portland, Oregon, I was interested in history and why countries are the way they are, why societies are the way they are. I think my father had a big influence on me in that way. But what was really important was at the age of 17, 18, I left home right after high school. I was fairly young. I left high school and I went to Europe. And at that time, my sort of outlook was rather left-wing, really. And I was very involved in a campaign at that time to raise money for people in West Africa. And I had a great deal of interest in West Africa, but I ended up living in Germany, in Bonn, for a year. And that had a tremendous impact on me, a tremendous influence. I began to see how the kind of narrative that we and I grew up with in Portland, Oregon, and most Americans did about World War II and about modern history is, well, understandably very America-centric. The United States in those days was just a dominant power, both not just merely militarily and economically, but also culturally. And so Americans were able to take for granted that the sort of the American way of looking at things is the way things sort of ought to be. But I learned in Europe, there's a very different attitude. For one thing, again, I left the United States in large measure to avoid the Vietnam War, which even at that age I thought was really stupid. And I was very struck by how differently Americans look at war than people in other countries. Whether in Europe, especially on the continent of Europe, memories of war are tied up with memories of privation, of suffering, of bombing, of death, in a way that Americans have a hard time understanding because, except for the American Civil War, war doesn't really affect America. The rhythm of life, the way of living sort of goes on. And it's a very common thing today, and it has been since I was a boy, for people to talk very easily, very lightly about going to war without really concern with the tremendous hardship and privation and misery that it can bring to other countries. Because for Americans, our wars are something that happens overseas, and increasingly happens without even soldiers, or not many soldiers, a very small actually numbers. We don't have draft anymore or conscription. And that made a big impact on me already when I was 18, 19. I worked in a wallpaper factory in Bonn, and I talked to people, and that had tremendous influence on me. And then I traveled around in Europe, then I made way to West Africa, where I worked for a time as a teacher in a secondary school in Ghana, in central Ghana. And that had also a tremendous impact on me because I was at a young, impressionable age where I was learning a lot. And what struck me very strongly is how people make societies. What I mean by that is that there's a very American idea that, well, if we just set our mind to it, we can just make whatever kind of society we really want. And it was obvious. It became very obvious traveling and talking to people and seeing different societies that people make the country the way it is. It's not that people just decide, people in Russia say, well, we're going to have a country like or a society like Sweden or Japan. That doesn't happen. And it also sort of underscores the kind of society and the way things are in a country reflects something about premises and attitudes that are that have developed over a long, long period of time, and that those things just don't change easily. Even at a young age, I was opposed to the Vietnam War, which was based on this premise that America could sort of elevate Vietnam, make it sort of like the United States. And we've seen this over and over in American foreign policy, where the United States goes into a country, Iraq or Afghanistan, with all sorts of noble-sounding talk about making sure women have freedom and people can vote and everything's going to be just great and it's going to be sort of like a... But anyway, those experiences at a young age had a tremendous impact on me. And I also traveled a lot in the United States. I lived and worked in different cities, and I tried very hard to sort of understand, well, why are things the way they are? I've always been very curious in that way. And all those experiences led me to believe very strongly in a view that that sort of gelled when I was in my early or mid-20s, some very, very important premises on which American society is based and the direction we're going on were wrong. They're contrary to history. They're contrary to the way people are. And I concluded at a very young age that the trends that were in place were not going to end well. Even at a young age, I came to the conclusion in Europe that the Americanization of Europe, which was very much happening, especially in Germany, but all over Western Europe, was going to be bad because the Americanization of Europe, to me, was going to be very more and more clearly, obviously, going to be the death of Europe. And again, this, what has happened in Europe over the past 80, 70 years since the end of World War II, we've seen a version of that here in the United States. There's been a drastic, historically very rapid cultural, demographic, racial transformation of the United States and of Western Europe. And it's not good. My worldview was sort of gelled at a fairly young age, and it's been very much in place since then. Now, what that means is the crisis of liberal democracy or a capitalist Western style form of government that we see now in Western Europe and in the United States was something I dimly or in outline saw at a fairly early age. And many of the points that I've made over the years in talks and writing and so forth have, I think, been vindicated by things as they developed. And I'm a little impatient sometimes when I hear people say things that are about what's going on in Europe and so forth, as if they sort of just discovered what should be, I think, obvious. It should have been obvious, I think, many, many decades earlier. But many people say almost no one really learns from history, in spite of the efforts to try to say, well, we should learn from previous civilizations, previous cultures, our ancestors and so forth, and people don't do that. And maybe that's a very modern thing, because around us is tremendous change materially. I mean, we have in the 20th century airplanes, automobiles, and space flights, and computers, and it gives the impression that somehow we've sort of conquered human nature or something, or that kind of dramatic change, I think, gives many people the illusion that they can also just make society or people as they wish. Well, that's I think, an arrogant and wrong one. Anyway, that's something about myself. We try very hard.
I'd like to ask more about this. I think there's a lot that you've said that I could pick up on. How old were you? You said 17 or 18 when you left.
I left the United States just before my 18th birthday, because the 18th birthday was supposed to be decisive about being drafted into the military. But that's why it happened at that age.
Right. Okay. And what year was that?
1969.
Right. Had you ever been abroad before that?
No, I hadn't. My parents, I'd been to Canada, but I hadn't been to Europe or outside the United States.
Yeah.
Canada.
So what kind of experience was that? I mean, in various ways, what did you learn and what did you see when you visited the old world for the first time as a, no doubt, a very energetic 18-year-old? I'm interested in how it struck you, because it must have been a complete change of tone.
I stayed for a while with a couple, an older woman and a young man. And the woman had been a child during the Second World War. The man had been also, an infant during the war. And she was very leftist, really, sort of internationalist, progressive, you might say. She had been a writer for one of the daily newspapers in Munich, but she was now living in the Rhineland. And her experiences about World War II were very important. She had been born in Silesia. And as a girl, she and her parents were forced to walk from Silesia to what later was West Germany, along with many other millions of ethnic Germans were expelled or were forced out of lands that they had lived in and their ancestors lived in for centuries. Nobody talked about this in America. This is just completely unknown. The idea of Germans or their allies in World War II as victims is something one just didn't hear in the United States. And so that was a kind of a shock, really. I mean, it really was unsettling to hear a whole people talk about experiences. And I don't mean just Germans, too. This is the misery, the suffering of Poles or Hungarians and so forth. It's just, I mean, it's now better known and people have access to this in the internet now, but I had a good education. I was more informed about the world than many people of my age and so forth. But this was just not talked about. We heard about, of course, the Holocaust, and we heard about what happened to, but this is typical of the United States. I mean, very much the how we look at the Second World War is very much influenced by Hollywood, by movies, in which and it was also something that really affected me, how the really major fighting in World War II and the major killing was on the Eastern Front in the East against the Red Army and the Soviet Union, not the American landing on D-Day with Private Ryan or John Wayne or anything like that. That alone was something that, and also because I lived with people and I also learned German during that period of time, I was very struck by many Americans who go to Europe or go to other countries. They don't really think of these countries and these people as sort of real. They sort of think they're visiting a kind of Disneyland or a museum or something. They don't relate to the people as they have their own families. They love their children just as much as Americans do. This is something I was very struck. For example, I spent an evening with some GIs in Luxembourg when I was seven, just after I had landed, and their attitude about the people living there was so detached or even disdainful. One thing GIs would say to each other is, "Where are you from in the world?" The world being the United States. Now that's changing, and especially in recent years, and especially among younger people. But this kind of idea that the only limit to what America does is just the decision of how we use our tremendous power and influence, because basically anything we really set our mind to, we can make it happen. But again, I was very influenced at that time by the Vietnam War, which was a tremendous shock for Americans because things didn't work out. And millions of Americans out of that experience concluded, well, I guess our government can lie and can deceive the public, which is the truth. But that was just the beginning of a series of things happening since the 1960s and 70s that has shaken confidence by Americans in their government. It's hard really for younger people to realize the extent to which up until Vietnam, people thought the president and the government told the truth. They were trustworthy. I mean, what I'm saying is borne out by all sorts of public opinion polls that have shown this steady erosion of confidence by Americans in their leaders and in their political, in their government and in their institutions. It's gotten to the point now where there's this tremendous cynicism, jaded attitude by so many younger people. But see, my experiences helped me, you might say, see that in a way that many people of my generation did not at the time, and only had to. That was very important. Another thing too is talking with people, and I don't mean just in Germany. I also worked briefly in Belgium and in France. And their experiences of World War II were very different than what many Americans would think or assume. But I don't want to take too much time going into detail about all of that.
Yeah, I didn't. I actually wasn't asking about World War II. I meant more broadly, what was it like for an American at a young age, but still formed, your attitude, 17 years in America, what was it like for an American to step into the old world for the first time, leaving aside World War II and the Holocaust and all that? It must have been a culture shock for you.
No, well, okay, I don't feel, I can talk about my own experiences, but and talking about what Americans might think about it's a culture shock in a sense. But no, I mean, I already felt a strong feeling that Europeans are like Americans, who's the only difference in a sense being that the white Americans, anyway, their ancestors for the most part came from Europe and they got transplanted to a new place. Again, I'm looking really from the vantage point of experience and age. There one big difference that really struck me is this American attitude, which again is not what it used to be. This idea that things are always going to be good; they're getting better. The American idea is that living well and things getting better is just almost taken for granted. Europeans have a sense of tragedy. I don't mean bad things happening. I mean that there's a tragic dimension to life, and this is reflected in Shakespeare. It's reflected in Greek plays from even before the Christian era. A kind of sense that good and bad is not something that is easily discernible. That's I'm talking in a way in a more sort of philosophical sense, but this is This is the difference between a young, still, you might say, adolescent society that America was and has been up until, I think, fairly recent, and a mature one. America has a kind of youthful sense, but there's not a, it's not, it's it doesn't it's not aware of, you might say, of the tragic dimension of life. Americans, well, Donald Trump is a personification of it. For him, what's important is winning. That's a kind of silly way, really, of looking at it. I mean, great figures, heroic figures in literature and in history, often aren't winners. They die. Their end is tragic. But that's part of their greatness, in a sense. That's very un-American. That's not a way that Americans like to look. I'm just right now reading a book that compares this very different attitude, not just of Europeans, but this is true of, I think, in all more settled, mature societies. Another difference, too, is that my generation was told over and over, you're the smartest, best, most enlightened generation ever. It's flattering to hear that, but it's not true. Whereas more mature societies have a kind of reverence, or at least a respect, for older people or their ancestors. There's a greater respect for accumulated wisdom in a sense that's very un-American. The American attitude has always been. And again, this is changing right now because things are breaking apart. But there's always been this attitude that we're not going to be held back by heritage or tradition. We just get the job done and we move ahead and make things happen. That's a very, very American thing. I mean, de Tocqueville saw all of this. It's kind of exuberant confidence that things are good and they're just going to get better. And it's understandable. I mean, when America was founded as a country in 1776, white Americans lived better than people anywhere in the world because land was cheap, because resources were just seemingly infinite and boundless. That's something Americans have not dealt with the really horrible experiences that almost all other older civilizations have had to deal with at one time or another. Now, again, I guess I'm talking in sort of from the perspective of my age now, but at the time, I was only dimly seeing all of those kinds of things and the way people talk. Another point, too, I guess, is that even Europeans will sort of look with at Americans, even this was clear from talking to people, with a kind of chagrin at the kind of childish exuberance that many Americans have, and this is it's hard for people, of course, to be aware of themselves and how they look to other people. But my experiences overseas helped me to have a perspective that I think many other people of my generation and my age group did not have.
Yeah, I think that at that time, it was probably very common for Americans to have, like your average American, to have never traveled abroad. Whereas nowadays, and to have little education and little culture, little few TV shows or films from abroad. Whereas I think nowadays it's probably much more common, if not for them to have traveled abroad, then they'll at least have seen TV shows and stuff from abroad. The example I always use of this is Alien 3. I'm convinced that at the time when that was released, it was I heard that, and that was 1992, that Americans didn't like it because of all the regional British accents in it. Whereas now they've watched Game of Thrones and mm-hmm. and similar things, so there's a sort of a very different perspective. But that's right. Why I asked you about that, because I think that at that time, the late 60s, in a way, you could say that was the height of America, the peak right. of America. Even while the Vietnam War was happening, and even though the Civil Rights Act had happened and all of that, the late 60s was still like the moon landing was about to happen, and it was peaking at that moment. And And so you could it would be understandable that Americans, ordinary Americans, would have a huge sense of confidence and optimism about right. their country and about just the way the world works and about the way life is. So that was why I asked you. Well, I always am curious about an American's first experience of the old world, because I had the opposite. I had my experience of America, and it is very different. And it was certainly a culture shock for me for the first day or two before I settled in. So that was why I asked about that, and especially because of the time, because at that moment, America would be probably as un-European as it has ever been, I would guess, in terms of its boundless confidence.
Right. And also, double down on the point you're making, at that time, Europe was still, in a sense, recovering from the destruction of the Second World War. America came out of the Second World War as the one important country that hadn't been destroyed in the war. Except for the poor young men and being killed in the war or actually in combat, America was more prosperous during the war. It didn't mean bombs falling. It meant there was jobs aplenty, wages went up. That's a very different experience, whereas the Europeans not only were recovering, but they looked to the United States, both for objective reasons, but also because they're under, you might say, American hegemony, as the model. That's the way to go. And so that's understandable. And also, John F. Kennedy is probably the last president who was able to personify both a tremendous confidence that we can do whatever we set our mind to do, that America's right, but also the last president who also personified a kind of progressive confidence in the future. We're going to deal with the problems of race and society, and we're going to take care of it. John F. Kennedy, in his short administration, he came into office in January 61, and he was killed in November of 1963. He founded both the Green Beret Special Army units and the Peace Corps. Both sides of this kind of view that the Green Berets were tough. And in his inaugural, he emphasized how we'll pay any price, fight any foe, support any friend to support freedom everywhere in the world. And of course, that's far more than any country can really do. At the same time, he seemed to be a person who was going to continue, you might say, the desegregation, and everything was going to work out. Since then, we've never really recaptured that that confidence in both strength and, you might say, progressive egalitarianism at the same time. And Johnson tried to do that, but he got bagged down in the Vietnam War, and his administration ended ignominiously, ended in a fiasco. And he decided not even to run again for president. Then came Nixon and Watergate. And ever since then, you might say the split in the American kind of personality has grown to the point now where we have this tremendous phenomenon of the Trump administration. Having said that, it's interesting to me that Donald Trump and Joe Biden both grew up in the 1950s and 60s, and each of them, each in his own way, represents this idea that we should get back to that somehow. The Trump slogan is "Make America Great Again." What he means in a vague way is we want to return the clock back to the days when America was respected, Americans were confident, everything was going well. And Biden and people of his generation on the Democratic side, they have the same view. They want to get back to a kind of Kennedy era too, where it's all going to work out. And it should have been obvious that that was a delusional view even then, but it's more and more obviously delusional now. And we're seeing now the torch being passed to a generation of younger people who are far, far more skeptical, jaded, and much less optimistic about the future than their parents or grandparents.
And those two men actually represent the two halves that we're talking about, because Biden talked apparently positively about the fact that America was going to be less and less white. And he said an unrelenting stream of immigration. And I think he said that he said something like, there's a famous clip of him where he said something like, men like me of Caucasian European right. descent are going to be an ever smaller percentage of the population. And he was saying that that was a good thing.
Right.
And the future, presumably if he wants to recreate the 50s or 60s, he wants to do it, but with a beige brown population,
right?
Which is just an utter impossibility to anyone right. with any common sense,
right? But it shows that both for Biden and there's a Trumpian version of it, that there's definitely. Something magical about America. It can do the exceptional, the impossible, and both Democrats and Republicans believe in this idea of American exceptionalism. When you try to pin down people, what does that mean exactly? Well, for Democrats, it means that Obama said this explicitly on one occasion, and Biden also, that America can, in spite of the fact that it's more and more diverse racially, culturally, ethnically, religiously, in all those ways, America is so exceptional that we can make it work, even acknowledging that it's never worked in history before. We're special. And there's a Republican version of it, too. Which prefers more or less to ignore the whole racial aspect of it, but nonetheless has this idea, whatever we set our minds to, because we're special, we're Americans, this is going to happen. In the 1960s, it wasn't necessary to talk about it in rhetoric so much, because at that time, America was the dominant power in the world, economically and so forth. I mean, if you wanted tractors, the only company really that made tractors was Caterpillar. The automobile industry of the world was dominated by the big three of Detroit, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler. In the 60s, the very first cars were coming in, imported cars. First, they were the Volkswagen Beetle, and then these little boxy Toyota Corollas. And they were considered, well, looked upon with a kind of condescension. Yes, well, these funny little cars made by these little countries, they're trying to copy the United States. But Detroit had this confidence that, well, they can try, but real cars, full-sized muscle cars, they're made in America, and didn't really understand how the challenge would grow to the point where today, the two biggest automobile companies are Volkswagen and Toyota, not General Motors. Chrysler's gone, disassembled, and so forth. But see, in those days, there was a kind of objective basis on this, having this view of this American exceptionalism. Now that is disappearing, and so that's why people talk about it rhetorically in words more, I think, than they did in the 60s, because that's about all that's left. It's almost like wishful thinking. I mean, an expression of a really wishful thinking, and people know this. And then there was a revival of their one expression was Ronald Reagan. He had this idea, we could welcome people from oppressed countries. There's a magic to America. It's a God, a divinely, providentially anointed country. And that he told people America's greatest days are yet to come. And I think he's the last president who really believed those words. He had this real faith in America. Now politicians can say these things, but they say so with far less, I think, sincerity or belief than presidents did during the Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and even into the Reagan years.
I remember there was a film, Wall Street, from 1987, and the yuppie character, Gordon Gekko, referred to, I can't remember the exact wording, but it was something like, we need to fix this dysfunctional corporation called the United States of America. And first of all, there's the optimism there, but there's also the pessimism of saying that this is dysfunctional. So something had clearly changed. For that to be a line of dialogue that rang true with anyone, something had clearly changed between the 60s and the
80s. Yeah. Well, the Donald Trump slogan is "Make America Great Again." He's acknowledging that America's not great. He's acknowledging something's really wrong. That was even unthinkable in the 60s or 70s. Nobody would say in 1969, "Make America Great Again." It's great, full stop, period. But now there's a recognition, no, it's not, something's really wrong. And whether people regard themselves as Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, one thing is clear, things have not developed the way both conservatives and liberals said they would on racial terms, domestically, but also internationally. It's not worked out the way we were promised by the media and by our political leaders. The challenge of China is something that I think American political leaders don't really fully grasp, don't really fully yet comprehend how important and unstoppable this challenge is. The idea was that once countries threw off the shackles of communism or whatever, they would just develop in a way that would be more or less friendly and happy with the United States. They would acknowledge the, you might say, the leadership of the United States, and everything would work out. They didn't really understand. That's not how Chinese are going to look at the situation at all. Movies and newsreels and so forth in the 50s and 60s and television talked about China or the Asia and Asian countries as with this kind of idea, the inscrutable Orient. They're very mysterious how they do things. Well, mysterious to us maybe, but of course, if you're Chinese, they don't see it at all like that. For centuries, Chinese civilization and culture were very preeminent. And in fact, the very word China in Chinese means the Middle Kingdom, the central country. In a way that it's very difficult for them. There was always this kind of attitude about Asia. Well, even if they're smart, they still need our tutelage or our guidance so they can be like the United States. And this has been a theme. Now, it's far less, American leaders are far less able to make that presentation of reality when more and more it's obvious that the United States society itself has such deep-rooted problems that being a leader or being a model for the world is just not in the cards in the way that it was in the 50s or 60s or 70s.
Yeah, again, to mention another film, and actually from the same year, Full Metal Jacket, there's a character, and it's set in the Vietnam War, and there's a character who says, we're here to help the Vietnamese, because inside every gook is an American trying to get out.
Well, yeah, you're citing movies, but this was this point was made over and over by American politicians too. This idea—that's
what I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just in movies. There's this idea that in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, the assumption was, well, the world should just realize we're the model, and if they don't realize it, well, too bad for them, but we're going to push, cajole them to understand that. And the way in which Europeans sort of followed the lead of the United States was gave Americans this added confidence that, yeah, we're the leader and they should sort of follow our example. Again, that's breaking down, I think, obviously now to almost anyone who pays any attention to what's really going on. In fact, the Donald Trump and the MAGA movement, I think, very much wants to believe these things, but even people in the MAGA movement, even the supporters of Trump, have really grave misgivings about how truthful that is. But they want to hear it because the alternative is even more unpalatable, even more unpleasant.
Yeah, it's existentially threatening.
Right.
I think that there was Vietnam, and then there was the Gulf War. And then there was Afghanistan and Iraq in the early 2000s. I don't know when the Iraq War formally ended, but the Afghanistan War dragged on for 20 years and ended basically with withdrawal and as far as I can tell, just a complete restoration of the Taliban and the situation that had preceded America's invasion. So it's either way, America certainly did not reinvent Afghanistan and did not turn every Afghani into an American. So you've got a set of military or geopolitical failures there, I guess it would be fair to say. And so you can understand if the American self-conception has been completely changed by this, as much as by anything else.
Right. Well, my wife and I were in Vietnam a few months ago, and I've been very interested because of my own experiences, but also just my interest in the world about Vietnam. The Vietnamese economy is booming. It's going through a period of rapid economic and development similar to what China did 10, 20 years ago. And it's remarkable that the Vietnamese have less, I think, angst about the legacy of the Vietnam War than Americans do. Donald Trump just recently said in a speech a few weeks ago, well, if we could have won the Vietnam War, we could have won in Afghanistan, we could have won in Iraq. He said that, all of those things, if only, but the problem is we were too politically correct. But with the implication that if I was in charge, we would have, quote, won. Well, he doesn't seem to ask himself, what's the point of winning? After the Vietnam War is over and America's out, there was a bad period in Vietnam, but today Vietnam and for years, Vietnam and the United States have been very close because the great rival for Vietnamese isn't the United States or France, which they fought, but China. But the American mentality during the Vietnam War was that this communist monolith of China and Russia and Vietnam was this great threat to the United States. And so it had to be stopped in Vietnam or else it would, like dominoes, spread all over the place. Well, in fact, the whole schema, the whole idea of what was going on with the Vietnamese and Vietnam was wrong. The Vietnamese were fighting to unify the country, or the North Vietnam was to unify the country, and they were first and foremost nationalists. Now, Vietnam is the third or fourth largest importer of material to the United States after Mexico, Canada, and China. And relations have been very good. Now they're kind of confused with Donald Trump because he can't seem to make up his mind what the trade policy should be. But the point is, he doesn't ask himself, and Americans have a hard time asking himself, well, what was the whole point of the war? Why even fight the war? Because at the end of it, we would have saved everybody a whole lot of misery and death if we had just not even, because the end result was Vietnam was on good terms because Vietnam wanted to be part of the whole world trade situation, and it is. But anyway, this is something very different for Donald Trump, because Donald Trump wants to be a winner. He's less concerned about what's the point of these conflicts, or what's the point of doing all of that.
You said that America wanted to be the model for these other countries, and that was ill-fated. Somebody has said in the live chat, it's made an interesting point that, hold on a second, we kind of are the model, though. China today is just a giant ersatz skyscraper America now. And this is an interesting point, because consumerism, corporatism, neoliberalism actually does seem to have taken over a large part of the world, just not under the auspices of America it's as such, but neoliberalism has spread as an ideology, and then America becomes the model for that because that's the biggest example of it, and so these countries then look like ersatz Americas. What would you say about that analysis?
I don't agree with that, because in China or Vietnam or some other countries I could name, there's a big difference between this American idea of capitalism, neoliberalism, or so forth, than those things. Yes, it's true that China to give the most obvious example, wants to increase living standards. Consumerism is very much in play. Free enterprise is encouraged. But all of that is subordinate to the agenda and the interests of the nation. China, whatever is happening in economic life, is subordinate to the interests of the nation as the government sees it. Whereas in America, and underneath that and with that is this very strong sense of China, Chinese national identity and Chinese interests and Chinese heritage. That's very different than the consumerism and the economic activity of the United States or of Western Europe, which believes that a kind of universal, we're all consumers, we're all human beings, borders shouldn't really matter. For China, they very much matter. And in Vietnam, they very much matter. China, now to put it another way, officially, the Chinese government refers to its form of government as socialism with Chinese characteristics. That is Chinese socialism, or if you will, national socialism. The same thing in Vietnam. They refer to it as a, I forget the exact words, but basically it's socialist, quote unquote, but with free enterprise and encouragement of competition, but all of that is subordinate to the interests and the welfare of the people in the nation. And that's a very different thing than the United States. The United States has a great difficulty even defining what it means to be an American. The American identity is the emphasis on the consumer or the individual. That's the end of the identity, not the beginning. And whereas in China or in Vietnam or these countries or Japan, too, the nation is very important. They're not willing to follow the American model ideologically when it comes to every other aspect of it. So I think there's a confusion between individualism or consumerism on an individual basis and what you call modernism. You use the word modernism. No, I mean, having modern conveniences and those might be modern, but they're not. That's not liberalism necessarily at all.
I don't think I said modernism. I think I said consumerism, corporatism, materialism. Maybe, but it doesn't matter.
Well, it doesn't matter. But the point is, it's not the same thing. And The American model is ultimately we're striving for a kind of one world where everybody is going to be an individual. They're going to be nations shouldn't really matter. This goes back again to World War II, and it's a point I've tried to make over and over about trying to understand that the ideology that's in place in America today found its real foundation during the Second World War. And the average American in World War II thought, well, we're fighting for America and we'll get rid of the bad guys and then life will go on. But that's not what the American government and Franklin Roosevelt, he said he was fighting for a new world civilization. This was over and over this point. And the Roosevelt government took the view that the wartime alliance with the Soviet Union was the foundation and the necessary foundation for a new world order in which the United States and the Soviet Union would be partners because both countries and both governments accepted this idea of one world. Of course, there's a Soviet version and there's an American version. And very few Americans really took that seriously or understood what the implications of all of that are. They sort of thought, and this is still the tragedy of America today, many Americans think we can have a kind of universal ideology on the one hand and maintain our distinctive Western, white, European cultural and heritage here in the United States at the same time. That's not going to happen. That can't happen.
It's ironic that both ideologies are universalistic.
Right. That's right.
But it's a huge irony, given that they were, well, in a way, that's why they were at loggerheads in the Cold Wars, because each of them was...
They were rivals. They're rivals for power. You know, the Chinese, I mean, every country has a kind of external cultural tool. The British have what they used to call British councils to spread British cultural influence. The Americans would have similar things, Voice of America and so forth, spread. And but the China's, their equivalent is called the Confucius Institutes, which is just about impossible to reconcile with communism, because Confucianism and the whole Confucian outlook, which is very, very in place throughout the East Asia, supposes that the fundamental healthy form of society is hierarchical, not egalitarian. And that's a very deeply rooted thing in European culture. And I would say in any healthy, long-lasting society, there's a realization that the normal and the only healthy form of society is hierarchical, not egalitarian. And pushing for egalitarianism, I don't mean by equal opportunity, but equal outcome, that human beings are sort of plastic, that is, I think, contrary to life, to human nature, to history. And it's a reality that many Americans have not quite worked out yet. Remember, whether people who call themselves MAGA Republicans or Democrats or progressives, they believe they believe in equality in political life. They believe every person should have the same amount of political power, one vote. That's not how China or Vietnam or throughout history, most societies have looked at how society and how political life should be organized.
If you had to predict, where do you think America is going to go from here? I mean, obviously, I don't mean in the short term, like the next 5 years. I mean, how could you foresee America, or the American people, rather, digging themselves out of this existential pit that they're now in? We've talked about the various things that have led to this, but I think we don't need to describe it now. We all know the situation. What do you think could be the resolution for this?
That's a very difficult thing, given America's history. And the reason I say that is that when the Soviet Union fell apart, almost everyone in the Soviet Union was conscious of an identity and a heritage different than the Soviet experience. When the Soviet Union fell apart, Uzbeks could go back to being Uzbek, or Ukrainians could be Ukrainian, or Estonians were Estonians. And of course, Russians could fall back on a long history and heritage of being Russian. And so when the Soviet Union fell apart, it naturally broke up into national units that reflected some strong heritage before the Soviet Union. We don't have that kind of heritage here to fall back on here in the United States. Americans have an immense difficulty imagining a future that isn't some version of what we have had in place for 250 years. Next year will be the 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States. And Americans are very uncomfortable speculating where this can go. And it's also very difficult to say, because unlike France or Italy or Germany or Poland or Russia, the United States has had the same flag in place, more or less, I mean, with different stars, the same currency in place, nominally the same constitution in place for 250 years. But most countries, or many countries, have had tremendous changes in currency, in flags, in constitutions. France has gone through, in that period of time, autocratic monarchies, the Paris Commune, I mean, all sorts of different kind of, and even different currencies, too. America hasn't gone through that. So it's very difficult for Americans to even talk in the kind of terms that are implied in your question. This is a big impression and big experience that I had in Europe, especially when I was a student at the University of Munich in the 1970s. Europeans can talk about different forms of government in a way that's very odd and very difficult for Americans to even discuss, because we haven't had any other forms of society to compare to. I'm using Germany because I was living in Munich, but people can say, well, there's communism, and we talk about socialism, and they would even ask, well, what does democracy actually mean? Americans don't have those kinds of conversations. If you ask an American, they will say, well, America's a democratic country. And playful mood, I'll say, well, when did America become a democracy? And they'll say, well, it's always been a democracy. I said, well, can a country be a democracy in which the majority of its population is not entitled to even vote, namely women? Then they think, well, I'm not sure. Can a country be a democracy in which slavery exists? That's a difficult question. Well, so when did America become a democracy? Was it a democracy in 1850 or 1870 when women didn't vote, when society was segregated, when Indians weren't even citizens of the United States? See, Americans don't really, they just sort of throw around these words, democracy. But what struck me very much when I was a student in Munich was how earnestly people discussed, well, what exactly does democracy mean for Europe? And the big point that many Marxists made at the time is, we believe in equality in political life and in economic life. In other words, there should be political equality, but Marxists would say, we want that same principle to apply in economic life. Well, that's very hard for Americans to get their head around, really. My point is, though, that we're coming to a time, because of the crisis of our society, people are being forced to ask questions that never people didn't even think about asking. Well, what exactly does it mean to be American? Who is an American? Now, your question was, where does this go? That's very difficult because we don't have a clear way about how it could break down. When the Ottoman Empire broke down, out of the wreckage of the Ottoman Empire came the Turkish national state. It's hard to see how easily things could break out or what could emerge from the wreckage of this thing called the United States of America today. But I am confident that as time goes on, it will be increasingly obvious that if white Americans are to even have a future as a group, as a heritage, America has to break down, because the underlying premise of this thing that's now called the United States of America is that it doesn't matter if the population is white or black or if what the religion is, we're all Americans. It's a kind of I think very empty civic nationalism, but that isn't going to hold together in any meaningful way. So out of all of this, I think something will emerge. And the best model of that is to look at other multicultural, multiracial, multiethnic, multireligious societies in the past and what came out of the wreckage when they finally fell apart. And that's why I think a great deal can be learned from the experience of the fall of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, of the fall of the Soviet Union, the breakup of the Soviet Union, of the Ottoman Empire, and of the Roman Empire. All of those provide at least some sort of idea of what might emerge out of the wreckage. It's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be very a fun thing, because it never is when societies break apart and change that way. But I don't see how it could be avoided. And it's amazing to me how much discussion there now is in media, in social media, and even in the mainstream media, comparing the United States today to the Roman Empire. Just the other day, the Chancellor of Germany talked about this is the end of the Pax Americana. Well, when he uses that term, Pax Americana, it's obviously a parallel with the Pax Romana of the Roman Empire. He's in effect saying that the American Empire is breaking up. Now, he's not concerned so much with what will happen in the United States. He's concerned with what this means for Europe. And he talks about how Europe has to get its act together. But it's more important than that for Americans is, what this implies about the United States of America. Something is really breaking apart. And the history of multicultural, multi-ethnic empires, when they do collapse, is they can still struggle along. They can jog along for a while, even after they're essentially dead under inertia. Things still happen. But they usually break down under some outside force. The Ottoman Empire, the Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, all broke down under the pressures of the First World War. The Soviet Union might be a not model. It just broke down under the, you might say, the inner contradictions of the whole Soviet system. And something along those lines is happening here in the United States today. One thing is clear. No one in the world looks at the United States and says, boy, I wish our cities were like the cities in the United States. Nobody in the world says, boy, I wish we could have a political system as healthy and as productive and as good as the American political system. American political system is paralytic, even for people who support it. We can't even agree every year now on a budget. Congress can't even agree every year on that. And even the standard of living we do maintain is now in place, is now upheld only because both Republican and Democratic administrations just run up enormous debts to keep things afloat and say, in effect, that we're going to give the bill to our children and grandchildren. That's not sustainable. Everyone knows it. It's widely acknowledged. But no one politically will do anything really to correct this suicidal or a course, because the alternative is it's just not in the cards politically in our system.
Yeah, so it would be electoral suicide, and the That's media right. would go crazy, and pension schemes would go crazy.
I mean, if either taxes are increased in any substantial way or benefits are cut in the other way, there would be huge. I mean, no, people couldn't get reelected. So politicians of both parties have to make extravagant promises that they can't fulfill, and that only feeds the cynicism, the distrust of the population towards the leaders, both Republican and Democrat. That's one of the reasons why it's a remarkable event of this past year that Mamdani was elected mayor of New York. He is a real. That's a real shift. An African-born, Indian heritage Muslim elected the mayor of the city that has the largest Jewish population in the world. That's a pretty astonishing thing. And a man who is the first one who says, I'm just not going to go along with the homage to Israel and so forth. It's admirable. I mean, at least he seems to believe something. He seems to have some principle. And but that's we'll see more of this when these are just shattering kind of iconic assumed ways of doing things that have been in place for many decades, and it's breaking down.
Of course, he also says that he wants to tax white neighborhoods more.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
I mean, he might have just been using it as a euphemism for high tax, high income neighborhoods. But either way, it was a racial term that he used, and people will take a signal from that.
Both Republicans and Democrats have signed off for decades on affirmative action programs and policies of discrimination, based on the premise that the reason that there's these racial problems, it's white people are responsible. They have to pay the price. And it's very hard to ideologically or consistently to say, Mamdani's, that's crazy, that's wrong, when it's Republicans and Democrats, but Republicans as well, who have signed off on these programs for decades. They've in effect acknowledged, it's really white backwardness or ignorance that has led us this. And so blaming white America for America's racial problems is something that's sort of baked in, given that even Republican leaders all say Martin Luther King's a great man. He's the greatest American of the 20th century. Well, if you believe that, then we should be proceeding along the path that he laid out, he and others like him laid out.
Yeah, we should all be voting for Mandani. That's what yeah, it's a very interesting thing that people are outraged about Mandani, but it is completely consistent with the course of American politics and social consensus ever
That's
since
right.
1965. So
Right. That's right.
there's,
That's right.
it's not some great departure. It's just being explicit. And I think there are quotes from MLK actually being explicit about this at the time, but they were sort of buried because it was a bit too soon when he was
Right.
talking about taxing white people more or something. I can't remember what it was, but it was something that nowadays, the far left woke progressives will see, but the civic nationalists would never see. It was that kind of thing. I think it's basically known now that MLK was essentially a communist, and he liked white women and so forth. I mean, that's an open secret. Where can it go from here? It seems to me that there are some truths that have been buried for a long time that are now simply going to have to explode to the surface. And I think you see this with, for example, the rise of Nick Fuentes. I don't know if you would want to say anything about that.
Well, I talked about, commented on him several times in recent weeks, especially after the interview he did with Piers Morgan. One of the most striking things about the interview with Piers Morgan, which I assume you're familiar with, almost everybody I've talked to has seen it or seen knows about it, is how ignorant or how blinded Piers Morgan is to the kinds of issues that Fuentes and other people are talking about. Piers Morgan, I guess he's consistent, believes, well, we just have to continue on in the path that we have been going on. And he did an interview a few weeks ago with Tucker Carlson, and he thinks London's just great, everything's fine. It's just these stupid people don't realize how this is good and this is the path we should go on. Well, that's not the way the people of England see the situation. The
No,
most
no, no.
popular party in the polls in England is a Reform Party. The most popular party in the polls in France is the National Rally, and in Germany, the AfD. All of these parties even exist because people are very unhappy with the direction things are going in. And Piers Morgan talked to Fuentes, thinking if he brings up, if he calls him a racist or he brings up the Holocaust, that Fuentes will say, oh, you're right. We have to bow down to this. This isn't working. It's not working, and it can't work. And it only underscores this astonishing blindness that Piers Morgan and so many leaders of the establishment parties in Britain and France, Germany, and the United States have about the reality that people can see all around them. I mean, in Britain, the Labour Party, the Social Democratic Party in Germany, the Socialists in France have all betrayed their own working class base. They've betrayed their own base of people, their own supporters. And the leaders don't seem to understand just how, just why they've been repudiated by the voters in the way they have, and why Starmer in Britain or Macron in France or Merz in Germany have only a minority really of popular support. Again, this is a partly a generational thing, and younger people have, I say this partly not just based on what I read, but discussions and talks I try to have with younger people and my own children. I have two children who are in their 20s. Their attitude is just enormously different than the attitude even of their parents or my generation, but certainly grandparents and great grandparents. And Piers Morgan doesn't seem to get that. And Fuentes is able to articulate this angst, this feeling, and this jaded disdain for the bromides and the slogans that the leaders of the establishment parties, both Democrat and Republican, have been spouting for years.
Yeah, I was going to point out that Piers Morgan isn't American; he's British, and that's interesting in itself because the same problems attend, as you've just illustrated, the same problems attend Britain
Right.
and France and Germany and Sweden and so forth. Maybe that relates to the Americanization of these countries that you
That's
alluded
right.
to at the start of this conversation,
Exactly. Exactly.
we've imported this racial ideology, white guilt, white slavery guilt, even though these countries didn't have slavery, all of that nonsense. And that has weakened us in exactly the way that it's weakened America. And right. so the problems that Nick Fuentes talks about are also in Britain. And so it's Piers Morgan should be aware of them. But he's of a certain generation. I don't know if I can say this to you, but he's a boomer. Well, he's actually Gen X, but it doesn't matter. The point is he epitomizes a certain mindset, which you clearly don't have, which is associated with that generation,
right.
Which is that really all it's that materialistic. It's the mindset that goes with the world as it was set up after World War II, which is that countries are really just economic zones. I remember having a conversation with an Indian immigrant to Britain. He'd moved here in the 60s when he was a child, and he'd been here ever since. And he was paranoid about working class white racism. He really clearly had a huge insecurity about white people, and especially the working class, whom he despised. And but anyway, I can't remember what the question was that I put to him. That it was something like, "Well, what's the solution to people feeling to racism, basically, and to people feeling that they don't belong in a country?" I can't remember what led to that in the conversation, but that's what it led to. I put that question to him, and he said one word: jobs. I thought that this was 10 years ago now, and I remember thinking, what the hell? You have no idea what you're talking about.
Right.
But from his experience in Britain in the 70s and 80s and 90s, that was all that anyone needed. And then they would feel they belonged. And on the other side, they wouldn't be racist against the newcomers. So the working class are racist because they're poor, because they don't have good jobs. And the immigrants, the Muslims, are doing terror attacks and they're raping white girls and whatever because they don't have jobs. They're economically underprivileged. And I just thought that, I mean, he didn't say that explicitly, but that is what he meant. Or at least that's the best answer he could give. And I thought it was a pathetic answer. Right. I thought it was so blind to so much of human nature. I couldn't believe that he was 40 years older than me, because I thought, what wisdom do you have for me, you silly fool, if that's what you believe? But that was the best that he could do, because he had his own reasons for saying that, because he didn't want to acknowledge that he simply doesn't belong in Britain. But I think also he had been given this mentality by the culture that he'd grown up in. And Piers Morgan also has that same mentality.
Right. Yes, right, exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's how I got into that.
No,
to
underscore your point, Piers Morgan might be British and Fuentes might be American, but they're talking about the same dynamic, the same tension, the same problems that afflict the entire white world, if you will. And that's why it's all the more fascinating to see both the clash and the blindness, you might say, that is transatlantic. It's not just confined to any one country. It's one of the reasons, though, to go back to you asking about my background. People of my generation, it's not a surprise that I'm not very my views are not at all popular with my contemporaries. I don't apologize for them, but I have them because my experiences were different. My upbringing was a bit different, but I had opportunities to see things that are not shared by many people, only a very minority of people in my generation. Now, having said that, I'm astonished at the vehemence that many younger people now express themselves about these issues in a way far more, you might say, pointed or harsh than I do. But I feel a kind of vindication that many, many younger people sort of understand and accept and agree with points that I've been making for years. But now that it's there's a harshness now and a kind of that bothers me a lot, because a lot of it is based on a kind of hatred of what's and loathing and fear of what's happening. When I like to think political leadership of any kind should be as wise and as measured as and informed and as knowledgeable as possible.
I think the problem there is, as you've said, that they simply can't step out of the bounds in order to be wiser than they are, because it's actually dangerous. It would be to explode the consensus, the post-war consensus, and in America's case, going back even further than that. So they're sort of hamstrung. They can't evolve, and they can't change the Constitution. They can't change the way of governance. They can't change democracy, our democracy, and so their options for rescuing this sinking ship are basically non-existent. And right. I think that is what really came up. I mean, that's the sort of underlying truth to that interview between Piers Morgan and Nick Fuentes. There's a young guy saying to the old guy, look, the world you created or the world you stewarded doesn't work. And I know, because I'm at the rough end of it.
Right.
And the older guy just couldn't accept that. And came up with delusions like, well, I live in London, it's so diverse. And then it turned out that the area of, like, because London is very much a patchwork, and the area that he lives in is massively white. So he was deluding himself, or at least lying to the audience about this. He doesn't live with diversity, he was lying that it's a good way of life. It's not, because everybody of every race tries to escape it as soon as they can.
Exactly. Yes. And Fuentes, at the beginning of the interview, he was confronted with something he said about his father in Chicago. I lived a year in Chicago. I got to know Chicago pretty well. And one of the things that struck me is that the quotes that Piers Morgan was throwing back at Fuentes, that's the way everyone, or not, I'm exaggerating slightly, but people routinely talk like that in Chicago. People are in Chicago, people are very aware of race. They avoid places where blacks are. I mean, that whether they're, and that's not just white people. I mean, Chinese, different people have that, are like that. Liberals are, they will act the same way, even if they don't articulate it and don't want to articulate and feel ashamed to articulate it. And the difference is that Fuentes and many other people are no longer ashamed to give voice to feelings that even liberals will feel, but will not, and will act on, but not articulate and not embrace.
Of course, they say that, well, we're moving because we're moving for the better schools, or right. we're moving for the low crime rate, or something, some drivel like that. It's a euphemism. Would you say that the political system in America, I don't know, this seems like a very obvious question to ask, but I'm interested in what you'll say about it. Would you say that this political system in America, as it is just now, doesn't have long left? Or do you think that whatever the changes that are necessary, they're decades away, or that the political system will survive them?
As one person says, it's difficult making predictions, especially about the future. I mean, I implied this earlier. Even a very broken system can lop along, can sort of struggle along and fitfully for a while. Oftentimes it takes some outside crisis to really finally bring it down. In other words, it can still go along with all sorts of problems for quite a while. The Russian Empire carried on, even though living standards were improving in the Russian Empire in the final decades of its existence, and also in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But it's just hard to see, because the American experience is not like that, as I tried to say earlier, of some of these other examples historically. Now, having said that, I'm astonished the extent to which even people who are invested in the system will admit, they can't see how it can go on. I mean, it's really bad. It's hard to get a consensus about much of anything anymore. And as I mentioned earlier, it's shown by the fact that every year we have this absurd spectacle of the Congress unable to even to agree on a budget with all sorts of emergency measures and government shutdowns. Those are all signs and symptoms of a sick and I would say mortally ill society. Having said that, though, who knows? There might be a government that holds on for a while with emergency decrees and so forth. Donald Trump's tariff policies are all based upon his declaration of a national emergency and just announcing what these tariffs would be. Tariffs are really taxes. That's an extraordinary grab for power. And I wouldn't be surprised if Democrats, when they get into office, inevitably as they will, they will have some really draconian measures against the people they don't like on the basis of a national emergency. And it's going to be bad. It's going to be not very pleasant, but it can still go along even with race riots and turmoil and killings and so forth, just like in the as the Russian Empire was falling apart in its last decades. There were numerous uprisings, strikes, discord, but the United States today has even less solidity, even less allegiance than the Russian Empire. I can't imagine if American government were to try to draft people as it did during the Vietnam War. I mean, millions, and I mean millions, would just not even cooperate in the very even first steps of that. And there's a realization, I think, that leaders have that that's just not going to happen. There's almost no stomach for any kind of sacrifice for this thing called the United States of America anymore. And there's not even even among people who are Trump supporters and claim to love the USA and shout USA all the time. Even their loyalty is very, very limited. And it's limited to a kind of sense of, well, what I'm really loyal to is people like myself. It's not really to the United States of America. And this tension will grow. So one thing I can say is this is a very unhealthy society we live in. It's not going to change, even if every illegal immigrant in the United States were deported, and even if all new immigration was stopped, the same trends, the same dynamic, both culturally, racially, and so forth, would continue. It wouldn't stop. And it might be postponed for a while and make people feel better. But this is all, it's not going to end well. And people see this, and nobody really wants to take responsibility for it. And everybody's pointing fingers at someone else. See, the American idea, and this is, again, I'm slightly generalizing here, but the American idea is that people are good. Everything will work out if we just are sort of good with each other. If things are bad, it's because there's evil people doing bad things. And if we just get rid of the bad people, it'll all be okay again. That's not what's happening in America. The problems we have are not because there's evil people, because their intentions are evil. It's because their policies are based upon premises and views about human nature and society that are wrong. And no matter how good the intentions are, if the premises of the policies are false, it cannot work well. It's not going to end well.
It seems to me that it points inevitably to balkanization. The United States is going to disintegrate. I don't see how else this can play out, because it's not just the racial tensions, but the now fervent political allegiances that people have, basically on the left and the right, for want of better terms.
Right.
They now identify, like, leftists, progressives are so committed to it, and despise right wingers so much, as we saw after Charlie Kirk was killed, that I don't see how that's reconcilable. And so I would think that, given the huge scale of America, but also given its form as a set of states, that what will happen is states will secede from the Union, or at least to some extent, and that the center just won't be able to hold anymore. And I I would envisage that happening piecemeal, slowly, but with the center just being progressively more and more humiliated as it just couldn't hold on to these territories, and people gravitate naturally to a place where they don't have to live with people they regard as the enemy and the other, to use a fancy leftist term.
Well, I would put it even more explicitly, I think. I think that people will be committed either to push on in the direction that America supposedly has been going on for 50, 60, 70, 80 years. That means we have to double down on squeezing white America. White America is responsible. We have to double down on DEI policies, egalitarian policies, a quasi-Marxist kind of future. Or the alternative will be, especially white Americans, will become more racially aware, and they'll do things on a racial basis. I do not see any successful breaking up of the country along secession by states. And the reason I say that is, let's suppose a state like Michigan or Illinois or whatever breaks away from the United States or tries to. What you'll find very quickly is large numbers of people in places that are more chaotic and things are bad will want to move into the state. And the state will very quickly face the choice, the decision, well, who do we let in and on what basis? In other words, they have to define themselves not just as a administrative unit called Illinois or West Virginia or Texas. It has to define itself on some basis, racially, culturally, something other than just a person as a human being. Because when it faces that crisis, people will say, well, I want to come into your state. I'll be loyal. Of course, people will say that. But then they say, well, are we going to let in 100,000, 200,000, a million refugees from other states who say it's better here than it is there? That's not going to work. Also, the states themselves are divided. The state of Michigan, for example, well, essentially, it has Detroit is a mostly black city. It has some other areas that are racially African-American, but the white suburbs are very different. In other words, the administrative unit called the Michigan doesn't reflect anything other than just a diversity that's only a replication of the diversity of the country as a whole. So breaking along state lines is, to me, just not, I mean, this is not going to, I don't see it happening. I don't see how it can happen in any clean or organized way. I do see if the federal government, for example, is unable to pay welfare benefits, or it inflates the currency so that Social Security payments and other payments become basically absurd. I could see things breaking down. There'll be riots. And then regional kind of governments or administrations would emerge in which leading citizens and businessmen get together to make sure the electricity is flowing and make sure that the water is still in place and that the roads are still maintained. But then it will have to set up boundaries of one kind or another, which are the formations of new states. This is how feudalism grew out of the Roman Empire. On a local basis, it wasn't along sort of clean administrative lines like states or so forth, or even the regions of the Roman Empire. It was on a much more local basis. I could also see another thing happening too. Let's suppose Alaska wants to break away. Now, that's a fairly clean thing because it's not even contiguous with the United States. What would happen very quickly is that China would approach Chinese officials would approach Alaska and say, look, we'll work out a deal with you. We'll buy all of your oil. We'll buy everything. And in return, you'll become essentially a protectorate or a vassal state of China. And many people in Alaska might say, well, that's the best deal we're going to get. Who knows? I mean, my point is, you'll find things really shifting rapidly when it gets to that level. Hawaii, what would Hawaii do as a separate country? It's really a kind of artificially subsidized thing, but I could see it making an alliance with Japan, for example, and saying, okay, in return for this, we'll be some sort of a subordinate state to some other entity, either Japan or China or so forth. And then Anyway, there's any number of ways that I could see parts of the Southwest being annexed in one form or another by Mexico, for example, where the population is overwhelmingly already Mexican. Or I could see, and also if things get really bad, many Americans will want to flee to Canada. There was a certain number of that happening even during the Vietnam War. Well, Canada will say, no, we don't want you. And then some provinces might say, well, we have to let in poor refugees. But then Quebec says no, and they're going to break away from Canada. Anyway, I could see all sorts of scenarios playing out. And it won't be as clean a break as happened during the fall of the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union. It will have a lot of the very nasty ambiguity and imprecision that happened when the Ottoman Empire broke up. But anyway, these are all very speculative scenarios of what might happen in the future. But one thing is increasingly clear, I mean, to me, that white Americans have to basically decide what they're going to do. They can't really run anymore. And you're seeing echoes of that already. Essentially, the MAGA movement, the vote for Donald Trump is essentially a protest, a reactionary expression of white America. That's really what it, I think historians will look back and they'll say that's what it was, and it is. But Donald Trump doesn't want to be explicit about that. In his inaugural address and in other speeches, he went out of his way to thank the minority of his Latinos or Hispanics or Blacks that voted for him. He doesn't even mention white Americans, because for white Americans, they are America. They don't have to be singled out, but it'll be increasingly obvious as whites are a minority and become increasingly a dwindling minority of the population that they will have to be explicit about an identity that right now is only implicit.
And I agree. I think that this just can't go on much longer. This lying about race and the delusion about race just can't go on much longer. It's really the thing that undergirds all of the problems that all of our countries are facing. It's this delusion that race doesn't matter. Right. Well, then the schools are terrible, the crime rate's terrible, life in general is worse than it was, and the economy suffers, and so forth. That's the wages of deluding yourself about race. So America as such, and it seems to be doomed one way or another. It's this experiment, this project, as it's been called, seems to be drawing to some kind of close, and it might be violent, it might be bloody, it might be messy, it might be clumsy, who knows? But one way or another, it seems to be ending.
Yes, that point's been made. And Fuentes, see, the real problem is for people like Piers Morgan, who are older, or Fuentes, they're really asking this fundamental question, well, is your racial identity even important? And Fuentes says, yes, it is. And Piers Morgan says, no, it's not. Okay, if it's not, we're just going to continue in the breakdown that everybody can see, and that even people of that generation, unless they die, are being forced to see. As I say, but Fuentes is saying, and more younger people are saying this, no, race does matter, and I'm white, and I'm not ashamed of being white. And that has big implications. I've compared this to the change of mentality that took place in 1775 and 1776. When Americans became unhappy with the policies of Britain, of George III and the British government toward the colonies, the leaders formed something called the Continental Congress. Up until January 1776, they still regarded themselves as loyal Englishmen who were petitioning the British government for their rights as Englishmen. Even after the battles of killing at Lexington and Concord and at Bunker Hill in outside of Boston, they still held out this idea, we want to work out some relationship with Britain whereby we can still be English and we're proud of being English. That changed in early 1776 by people who said, no, we're really Americans. We're a separate people. And it was immensely fueled by this pamphlet, Common Sense, by Thomas Mayne. He says, no, we're a separate people. We should cast off the ties with England. And once that consciousness took hold, it became obvious. It became obvious to everyone. And that's, I think, something like that, at least very likely, could happen with white Americans. White Americans are still trying to hold on to this thing called the United States of America. They still think, well, it can all work out. Why can't we all just get along? But at some point, that illusion, that delusional idea will break down, and white Americans will say, no, we give up on people who are not like ourselves. We're going to return to the idea about race that was in place and taken for granted up until the middle of the 20th century. And that just shifting that mindset will shift a whole lot of policies. But that will happen almost inevitably because it's not going to work. You cannot save this thing called the United States of America when the population is a majority and increasingly a articulate majority that doesn't even share the same heritage or the same values.
And despises them.
Yes, and despises them. Well, and blames them. That's right. Of course. And we're seeing this also we're seeing the development of this. And it's one of the reasons why Nick Fuentes has the following he has. And people now, Elon Musk has articulated this in his kind of offhand way that he does, that it's more and more obvious that the liberal agenda for an egalitarian America inherently, inexorably means policies that are anti-white. They're going to be discriminated. They're going to be disadvantageous to white Americans. And white Americans, when I grew up, had this idea, well, once the last vestiges of segregation were done away with, it would all work out. Black people would be just like white people with darker skins. That's not worked. That's not happened. It's not going to happen. It's obvious to anyone who sort of sees more of life in the world that that's the case. Different people make different kinds of societies. But it still isn't accepted even by the MAGA people, Republicans. They haven't yet accepted that reality. They want to still pretend that race doesn't exist. That's why MAGA people are very angry when people talk about identity politics. Oh, that's not what we want. We're all just Americans. But in fact, identity politics is the only politics that really matters. It's crucial. The rest of it is just rearranging tax rates or rearranging chairs on the sinking Titanic. But once identity politics becomes acceptable for white Americans, then things will change. Just as once Americans accept the idea, no, we're not going, we're separate from Britain, then the whole game changed. And that inevitably will happen. Something like that will happen because it's increasingly obvious that the country has changed too much to go back to Donald Trump calls when America was great. Well, it was a different country, and the world is different too.
Yeah, and that was the country yearned for by Ronald Reagan and celebrated by JFK. If America, the United States, is heading for is going to end in as we know it. I want to ask you a sort of whimsical question. If it is headed for the history books, what would you hope would survive of it, of the country that you grew up in?
This is a very good, well, implicit in this is a very good question. When did things go wrong? What went wrong? At what point did we go off the wrong path? To me, the problem has always been, it's not anybody's fault exactly. It's inherent in the situation. From the very beginning, at the Continental Congress, that made the Declaration of Independence and the Constitutional Convention, everyone took for granted that this is a country for white Americans, that the American Republic is a white people's country. Blacks were considered, they're not citizens. Indians were not citizens. That's what everybody took for granted. But they didn't, they weren't explicit about it. They didn't make it, they put it in laws, they put it in various things, but that was not spelled out, and they didn't make policies, because at the same time, there's always been a very strong individualism in America that says, well, I'm not really concerned about larger policies or the nature of the society. I'm just going to do what's good for me as an individual. And that's one of the reasons why people brought slaves. Slaves are cheap labor. They're advantageous to people in the short run. And even many people at the beginning who owned slaves knew on a certain level, this is not going to be good in the long run. Thomas Jefferson was one of them. Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. He couldn't have maintained his rather lavish lifestyle without slaves. He inherited slaves. But he knew this is not good. There's going to be a problem here down the road. And he worked out plans that whereby blacks would be bought and then deported from the United States. But he didn't do anything about it because it was much easier just to go along. What was advantageous in the short run. By the same token, American businessmen like cheap labor coming in over the borders from different countries. It means keeps wages low. They don't want to have to pay people a good daily wage for picking strawberries or harvesting apples or working on streets. So they sell out their own people, the working class of their own people, by getting cheap labor. And they know, even the very people who are hiring Mexican labor at a lower rate, they know, well, this isn't going to be good for the country, but they're doing what's good for them short run in their immediate advantage. And so that tension between what Americans sort of think the society should be like on the one hand, and what's advantageous and utilitarian in the short run, there's always been a clash, a tension between those two. And a society and America could afford to put off making a decision about that for years. People have known, for example, that conditions in the Black South, in the rural South, or in Detroit, or in Black areas of Chicago are bad. But the attitude of most Americans is, I'm not going to worry about solving it or dealing with the problem. I just am glad I move away from it. And that's the way Americans have dealt with social problems. Thank goodness I don't live there, Detroit or South Side of Chicago or any number of other places. And it's too high a price for politicians to try to get people to deal with these problems because it's going to cost money. It's going to cause some difficulty. Americans are far more willing to go to wars to liberate Afghanistan than they are to sacrifice to deal with the problems that we have racially and culturally here in this country, because, well, it's easy and more patriotic or fun, I guess, to bomb Vietnam or Afghanistan or Iraq than it is to really come to grips in a forceful way with the problems we have here at home. Anyway, my point is America is both has a collective idea or vision of itself as white Americans do on the one hand, but we have a very hyper individualistic society on the other that makes it very difficult to act in a collective way. And that's always been a tension. So, but it's not going to last. I mean, the Soviet Union finally decisively fell because nobody was willing to shoot or die or kill to preserve it. It came to a point in Moscow when the coup that tried to take power and preserve the Soviet Union said to the head of the Moscow garrison, well, I want you to shoot at these demonstrators. And he said, no, I'm not going to do it. Same thing happened in East Germany. Honecker was the last communist leader. He wanted the military. And the man says, I want you to put this in writing, so it's not my responsibility. And people didn't want to shoot at their own people. And there's almost nobody really willing to shoot or give their lives increasingly for this thing called the United States of America. And that's when that happens, it's curtains. It's you can see the end coming.
But in that scenario, what do you hope would survive? from the country that you grew up in? That's what I'm wondering, because you've said a lot that's very critical of America, but I'm thinking there must be a love of something.
Yes, of course. I mean, what I do love is the America that was already in place, but only implicitly or not very forcefully up until World War II or the 20th century. That is the America that Abraham Lincoln or Thomas Jefferson, they wanted a white America. They wanted a white republic. And Lincoln did more than almost any other president to try to make that happen. He worked out plans whereby blacks would leave the United States. He sounded this theme many times. But it really comes down to who are we? What's the we we're talking about? There are parallels of that in the lives of individuals too. When an individual is facing a crisis and a very difficult thing, he has to finally say, "Well, what's really important? What am I really willing to sacrifice for? What are my real priorities here?" And white Americans have to make that decision. We have just squandered decades of valuable time by allowing these problems just to be put off and put off and put off. And it's very important that people like Nick Fuentes are forcing people to ask questions or to confront issues that people more comfortably, especially of my generation, have preferred to just pretend isn't important or doesn't exist. That's not going to happen. And it'll become even more compelling a priority to talk about and to face in a consequential, intelligent way these issues of, well, what kind of country do we want, really? I mean, what is the role of race? And all these kinds of questions are going to have to be really addressed, because otherwise we just squander time and continue in the direction we have. It's like the Gorbachev years in the Soviet Union was called the era of stagnation. It sort of existed as it was really dying. People don't believe anymore the slogans that John F. Kennedy or Ronald Reagan used to say about America's greatest days. And each of them in his own way, and this is in Hollywood and so forth, had this idea of America was all going to sort of work out. That's less and less the delusional nature of that vision is becoming more and more obvious, especially to younger people.
Definitely. I think you're right, and it seems to be approaching some kind of head. And I've asked you to speculate about how that will play out. I realize, of course, that it's impossible to know, but it is interesting to speculate.
What's your view? I mean, what do you? Yes, I mean, what do you say? And also, not just with America, but about Britain. Where do you see things going in Britain?
Oh, that's a whole different thing.
Okay.
I'm not in that mode of thinking at all.
Okay.
But I am open to that question. But not just now. I don't know. I think that once America, the status quo in Britain and in all Western European countries depends on America. It hinges on America remaining strong. It hinges on Pax Americana. Once that ends, one way or another, then the countries of Western Europe will be free to decide their own destinies again. And I think until it won't be until that happens. I foresee a lot of upheaval in Britain, and I don't think it will be pleasant at all. To link back to something that we said earlier, I think that Britain rescuing itself depends on the Americanization of Britain not having gone so far that we don't even know what we want to rescue. That's really the issue, because this process ever since 1945 has basically been the erasure and undermining of any sort of national culture or identity. And so, yeah, I hope that enough of has survived by the time this cataclysm occurs, that that we have something to rescue, that we have something to salvage and restore and rehabilitate. And I think that we will, because our roots run very, very deep. And I think that most British people could, if they were to think about it, and if they were thoughtful people, could probably say, yeah, what I want to survive is the Britain that I have, that I know in my heart, that it's an image, it's an idea, it's not about values, it's certainly not about politics, it's something eternal, and or at least as eternal as the human brain can comprehend. It's thousands of years. So that, I think, is what I would hope will survive. But I think it will be largely quite similar to the breakup of the United States, in that it will be racial, ethnic, religion, I think, will be there, but I think it'll be mostly ethnic and racial. And I think the center will not hold. That's the way I see it playing out.
I see. It sounds like you're saying that if the United States does not hold, which is the sort of model since 1945 for Europe, or certainly Western Europe, if that doesn't hold, then it's a whole new game. It's a whole new people will be forced to sort of rethink everything then.
Yes, okay. Absolutely, because I think the United States is the guarantor of the post-war order. I think without the United States as the hegemon, as the world policeman, and the United States always speaks of this danger that, well, these other countries will find themselves again, and that's correct. That's exactly what will happen, and I think it will be a better world once that happens. Certainly in Europe it will, and that's not to say that, you know, I think the post-war era has been a nightmare for us. It's obviously been comfortable in some ways, and having America's military protection and so on. But it's also been an infantilizing and draining era during which tremendous and demographics, you don't even need to mention that. Even without that, this has been a very damaging and draining era for us. So, you know, comfort, I like it as much as anyone else, but you can't have too much of it when you're a nation. As a nation, I think it needs to be exercised and tested quite continually. Otherwise, it atrophies. So, and that's what's happened. So I hope that things return to a state where we can find ourselves again. And because I think we know what we need to find. It's but we are separated from it just now by America, I have to say. So, by the people that America's put here.
I have a subscription to The Economist, and it represents, you might say, establishment British economic capitalist interests, you might say. The headline here on this is the most recent issue. Europe's populist right, can they be stopped? And this has been a theme of The Economist in the last 6 months or so. They see that things are breaking apart, and they don't know how quite to deal with it. They think that the establishment parties have to do something to sort of show they're not just fumbling, and have to give some sort of dealing with immigration, even though The Economist still touts the great wonders of mass migration from outside Britain. But it knows that this is dangerous because it's feeding the rise of these anti-establishment parties. And that's why they have leaders here in Britain, France, and Germany and Italy, who are all sort of anti-establishment. And they're afraid of just losing control of the whole situation. That's The Economist's point of view. But of course, it's echoed by remarks by the Chancellor of Germany, the President of France, who are also worried that we've got to sort of get a grip on this thing, although they're very vague about what that really, how that would play out or what that would entail. They're very inspecific. They talk about how we have to prepare for a Europe without the United States, without the alliance. But I just don't see, especially in Germany or on the continent, how that can work. Maybe in Britain as well. But anyway, it echoes the points you've been making, I guess, is why I'm bringing it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't think that to answer that headline question, can the populist parties be stopped? I think individual parties could be subverted and stopped. I was talking about that with my previous guest, actually, the AfD. But populism, what they mean by that is not the Nigel Farage nonsense. What they mean is the deep will to survive among our people. Right. And I think the answer is no, it can't be stopped. So whatever they do with individual parties, the will to survive is going to be there, and I don't think they can stop it, no matter what nonsense they come up with.
Right.
But maybe I'm too optimistic.
Well, this latest edition more or less agrees with you that Farage's movement is rather flabby, doesn't have much backbone to it. It's more worried about the more militant people coming up in the AfD in Germany, and I think by extension in Central Europe. There's more sort of verve to the whole thing than there is in Britain or even in France. But all this, for the economists and for many of these people, it's also more worrisome. It's interesting that they don't have a headline that says, the establishment parties, how can they be saved? Because they've almost given up on that. It's hard to see how the Labour Party or the Conservative Party of Britain or the comparable parties in France or Germany or the other countries can even be rescued, because they've so discredited themselves in the eyes of their people. You know, apropos of what you're saying about what people feel in Britain, there's a very good review on our website of a book that was published in Britain that you're probably familiar with, in which a Englishman talks and encourages all these people who fought in World War II or involved in World War II to talk about their experiences, but more to answer the question, what do you make of what's happened to your country? Well, overwhelmingly, they're very unhappy. They see themselves strangers, alien in their own country. This is not the Britain they fought for in World War II. Many of them are just very even emphatic about that. And my father was also in the Second World War as a young man, and this is not the America that he wanted either, so forth. But my point is that this is a very atavistic feeling that is all over, and it's not being represented by the establishment party. One of the odd things is how Winston Churchill is being disrespected now by many younger people in Britain, not for having done the bad things he did to Britain, but because he was an imperialist, he was a racist, of course, and by modern standards. But it's ironic that even his totem, which is a very important one for modern Britain, is being dissed, you might say, now in Britain. And similarly with Franklin Roosevelt, he was the one who really wanted to push this new world, this one world. But now he's considered bad because he wasn't progressive enough or egalitarian enough.
And I think the same is true. I think exactly the same is happening with Abraham Lincoln, where he was a hero of the 60s, 70s, 80s liberal. But now he is being denied as a source of pride because, after all, he was racist.
Right. And so, a very imposing statue of Lincoln in Portland, Oregon, in the park blocks in downtown Portland, was torn down by the Antifa people and anti-fascists. And there's been no effort really to revive the thing or put it back up again, because even the people in charge are very ambivalent about this man who, by today's standard, is worse than Nick Fuentes, I guess.
Exactly. Well, let's end it there. There were a few super chats. Dardy said, fabulous getting a Mark Weber on Millennial this year. Thank you very much. And it should have happened before now, and I'm sorry that it hasn't. Open Borders says, has Mark seen the 1970s movie The Boys from Brazil? Did he see they are doing a remake on Netflix? I think this is a running, because he asked the same question to a different guest. So I think this must be a running joke. Have you heard of The Boys from Brazil?
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it. I know a little bit about it, but I actually never saw it. So I can't, right, okay. I shouldn't comment on it.
Okay. We can overlook that one then. All right. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, very interesting. So thank you very much for it. Is there anything you'd want to say in wrapping up before we finish about America and the prospects for the future?
I want to make a shameless plug for people who are viewing to check out our website, IHR.org. I would encourage that. You'll find a whole lot on our website. Not just we update it routinely with things that are relevant in happening now in the world, but there's a tremendous archive of, I think, very valuable, very good material, not just by me, but by many others as well, that I think is well worth checking out. So I encourage that. And people can sign up for our email bulletins that we send out of current events and news and comment, we call it. I've enjoyed very much talking with you. I like these conversations. You're a very good host. Very, very happy to be with you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it too. I'll be back tomorrow night with another four interviews. Let me see who's on. Right. Yes, we're starting an hour earlier tomorrow for Godfrey Bloom, then Mark Houghton, then Jared Taylor, and then The Distributist, and then the Midway AMA. That's going to be five streams tomorrow. And as I say, starting 1 hour earlier than usual. So, I will see you all then. But in the meantime, Mark Weber, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Welcome.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.